Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam and I will be talking with Dr. Karen Joint from the Harvard School of Medicine and School of Public Health about hospital readmissions, truth and consequences. Important topic, Adam.
It is, and we're going to hear a lot more about this because hospitals all across the country are actually needing to pay fines, many of them because of patients coming back into the hospital, being readmitted after being discharged. So loved ones already know about this. Hospitals are paying attention. Stay tuned. But first, Christy, we've got some important research that matters about organic foods and are they healthier?
About coconut oil and whether or not that can prevent cavities.
Well, I may need to go to Hawaii for that one. And it's about CPR or cardiopulmonary resuscitation. How long is long enough?
And about school bullies preying on children with autism.
And this is not the good kind of praying at all.
No, it's not.
Well, let's talk about our very first research. And I'm sure lots of our listeners out there, Christy, read about this or heard about it. But it's about research about organic foods. And are they safer than conventional alternatives?
And Adam, if I remember correctly, you do choose organic foods?
I choose organic foods and believe in them strongly. But I don't think I choosing them because I thought that they were necessarily safer in terms of the amount of nutrients, but I thought they just they don't have toxic chemicals on them. So for that point, I like them.
So this is a study looking, or a review of 17 human studies and 223 studies of nutrient levels in foods to try to determine if there are overall health benefits to choosing organic foods over regular foods.
And what they actually looked at were two different things, Christy. So they looked at this nutrient value. Were they healthier from the nutrients? And then were they perhaps safer in terms of toxicity? And these were conflicting findings. They didn't necessarily find that they were any healthier in terms of the nutrients, but perhaps they indeed could be safer with reduced toxicities.
So as I looked at this, they found no significant differences when they compared it to different allergic outcomes like eczema, wheezing, that sort of thing, or certain infections to the foods themselves. And they did find a difference in having certain pesticides in the urine, but they didn't find like meaningful outcomes that were different because of that exposure to pesticides.
Right. But there was a 30% decline in pesticide residue in the urine. Somehow that seems important. And I think for a lot of listeners, and maybe this doesn't change the way people view things, but I think being told that you have less pesticide residue in your urine, most people would say that's a good thing.
Right. We can't say based on this research that it makes a difference in overall health, but it's worth paying attention to for sure. I think I'll lean towards organic now, maybe.
And it may have less antibiotic resistant bacteria in that urine as well. So there's some evidence here. I don't think we say that this is conclusive, but I think it's important for a lot of parents out there to consider, what do you want for your children? What do you want for yourself?
And certainly, if you don't choose organic foods, washing them well is a good idea.
Absolutely. Speaking of washing and washing one's mouth, what about coconut oil and tooth decay?
Well, I like the study because I like coconuts and like coconut oil, and because it's a different way of thinking about oral health. So we know cavities in children are a big problem. And this was a study in Ireland looking to see if you took coconut, different types of oils, and treated them with enzymes like what happens in digestion, whether or not that had any effect on the bacteria.
Right. And so these were researchers in Ireland who looked at the impact of coconut oil, vegetable oil, and olive oil, and what happens when These are put in the same place as the bacteria that are common in the mouth, the Streptococcus bacteria, suggesting that perhaps these natural oils have an antibacterial impact that's known to cause tooth decay.
What they found was that of the three, only the coconut oil that was treated with these enzymes to simulate digestion, did show a difference in the ability to slow down or stop the growth of most strains of bacteria, including certain Streptococcus bacteria, which are the ones that cause tooth decay and cavities.
Right. So I think, you know, this doesn't rush out to everyone go purchase coconut oil, but I think this is really some good research that's worthy of more investigation here and looking at, again, natural ways to help, because a lot of the world's population may not have access to the sorts of things to prevent tooth decay, but yet this is a worldwide issue.
Or the foundation of new treatments for prevention. Now, this next study is about CPR and how long to do CPR. And the context here, I think a lot of people would say, well, you just keep doing it and just keep doing it. But a lot of doctors and people with experience have had concern over the years that at some point you have to decide to stop. And the longer you do it, the higher the chance that if a person lives, that they might be brain dead or on machines and not actually recover. And so all these decisions about when to stop.
I don't think we, particularly when people have a cardiac arrest in a hospital and CPR is done, we don't necessarily have good data about how long is the right amount here. And this article, which was in the Lancet Journal, looked at over 64,000 patients who went into cardiac arrest in the hospital at 435 hospitals in the United States to help determine what's the right amount, or is smaller better, or is longer better?
And they found that patients have a better chance of surviving if they were in hospitals that tended to continue CPR for 9 minutes or longer on average, compared with patients in hospitals who did it for shorter amounts of time.
Right. And actually, those that did it for a longer amount of time were 12% more likely to survive and go home. And there was no increased brain damage of those, at least as far as they reported. So it wasn't like the longer the CPR, the worse they actually did, even if they went home.
Right. So they were more likely to survive. And the ones who survived left the hospital doing just as well with their brain function and other measures than the ones who were more quickly resuscitated, suggesting that, I mean, that still there are some points where if it's not working, the team has to stop, but that maybe doing it at least 9 minutes is a good thing.
Yeah, I don't think you want to be on the low end of this area, and probably hospitals will need to revisit this to make sure that patients are given the appropriate amount of time, which tends to probably now be on the higher end. Speaking of appropriate and inappropriate, this last research article, Christy, I know it tugs at your heart.
It does. This is upsetting to discover through this research in the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine. You know, school bullying is a big problem, but it's much more likely to happen against children who have autism spectrum disorders, ADHD, other problems. Forming relationships or with their behavior really puts them at risk of kids being mean and picking on them in hurtful and harmful ways.
Yeah, this research, the authors looked at 920 middle and high school students who had autism and showed that almost half had been bullied, compared to only 10% or so of those who did not have autism and who had been bullied.
Well, and this is the most vulnerable group of children, and the fact that they are so much more likely to be victims, and it tended to be more the people who were high enough functioning that they weren't in the special education classes but were in the mainstream classes that were at the highest risk of kids doing really mean and harmful things. So I think this is important research and really draws attention to this issue that we need to do something about.
Right. I think for any of our listeners with children or grandchildren or friends with autism, they who are in school, this research should be pointed out to them and have them take it into the teachers, and the school systems need to actually probably revise some of their policies to pay special attention, knowing that they're higher risk here. Well, Christy, that'll conclude the research that matters, but we've had time to talk about school bullying and autism.
About prolonged CPR having some benefits.
Yeah, particularly for at least 9 minutes longer, and about organic foods may not be necessarily more nutritious, but maybe have less pesticides.
And coconut oil may help fight tooth decay. That concludes our Research That Matters portion. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Karen Joint about hospital readmissions, truth, and consequences. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're going to be talking with Dr. Karen Joint, instructor in Harvard Medical School and the Harvard School of Public Health, about an article that she had in the New England Journal of Medicine called Hospital Readmissions, Truth and Consequences.
Dr. Joint, we're so glad to have you with us today.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
You know, having a broad background from medical school at Duke and going to internal medicine and into cardiology, what was it that got you fascinated and committed into health policy and healthcare and hospital readmissions?
Well, I think it's actually been sort of a fun opportunity to try to understand both the day-to-day things that we see in the hospital and then the sort of systems issues that I think we all sort of have a sense affect our patients in the hospital. So certainly through residency and fellowship, we spend a lot of time learning about the intricacies of getting the right diuretic dose or choosing the right antibiotic. But I think it becomes pretty clear fairly quickly when you're working in the hospital that a lot of the difficulties that we see patients have extend beyond the hospital walls. And one of the most, I think, striking examples of that is when we see people come back into the hospital starting to think about what's happening to them once they leave. And so I sort of developed an interest in thinking through some of the policy movements that have been going on now around readmissions as it's become sort of such a hot topic from both the policy and clinical side.
Well, I think it shouldn't be unexpected that we focus now on this readmission of people to the hospital after the discharge, because haven't we cut down on the length of stay? So patients might have been admitted to the hospital for a week for heart failure a decade ago, and now it might be 1 or 2 days.
No, you're absolutely right. Length of stay has decreased quite a bit over the past 20 years and even over the past decade. And though we certainly don't know if it's causative, it does seem that there's been some relationship between shortening that length of stay and then a higher likelihood of our patients coming back. We also see in international studies that in some other countries where lengths of stay are much, much longer for things like heart attacks and heart failure, that their readmission rates do tend to be lower than here in the U.S. So while we don't have great evidence that it's causative, I think there's certainly a relationship between length of stay and readmission rate.
And what is it, do you think, or what's the biggest factor that's made readmissions to the hospital such a hot topic, as you say?
I think it's caught everyone's attention because it seems to be one of the few places in which we could both improve care and cut costs. So oftentimes we think about improving care as needing to do more. And in this case, it would be improving care by decreasing people's need to come back into the hospital. So it's sort of the holy grail of health policy or health reform is finding a way to both improve clinical outcomes and decrease costs and utilization at the same time. It turns out, I think, to be a little bit more complicated than that, but I think that's one reason that's gotten so much attention sort of in the current milieu of cost consciousness.
Well, I know we're going to get into your article in more detail and understand maybe the challenge to some assumptions, but I guess there's a concern I would imagine that lots of people have, perhaps you and researchers, but also I think our patients, which is that we tend to want to, that there's a belief that we tend to want to push them out of the hospital before they're ready. And I remember that there were state laws made that, you know, to prevent pregnant women after delivery from having to leave the hospital after a minimum amount of time. Is this a reality, or is this just this perception? I mean, we think we were improving care all this time, but we're also really trying to cut costs. That's been part of what we've been trying to do for two decades.
Right. No, I think it's a very valid concern. I think as clinicians, we spend a lot of time trying to improve the inpatient care process. But I think one of the things that's becoming more and more evident is even if we can improve the things that we do in the hospital and do them faster and faster, for example, we can get a CAT scan or an MRI at 2 in the morning now instead of having to wait till the next day. Giving patients the time to really understand their disease and learn about their care plan and understand how they're going to be able to take care of themselves at home may take more time than actually just the technical details of what we need to get done from the sort of physical side in the hospital.
And along those lines, as we touch on the issues of, you know, I wonder to what degree people have studied communication and patients' understanding of what's happened to them and what the instructions are in that relationship to just coming back to the hospital because they still feel lousy.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a little bit difficult to study, partly because, as you can imagine, patients bring such different resources and abilities with them to a hospital stay. So probably the best evidence we have is looking at patient-reported discharge planning. So quality of discharge planning as measured by the hospital's reporting its performance to CMS has very little relationship with readmission rates. Patient satisfaction with discharge planning does have a relationship with readmission rates, i.e. more satisfied patients don't come back into the hospital as often. So I think there probably is something there to if we could improve our communication with patients, that to some degree we can reduce readmission. Now, the trick is sorting out, that may be true for any individual patient, but the differences between patients in their support and their ability to comprehend issues of health literacy and their prescription and the recommendations, I think get even more complicated than just communicating a discharge plan.
We're talking with Dr. Karen Joint of Harvard Medical School and Harvard School of Public Health about her article in the New England Journal of Medicine about hospital readmissions. And Dr. Joint, I know that when the services, if you're on admitted to a family medicine service and if you're admitted to an internal medicine service or surgery, everyone collects data on their readmission rates. And most recently, you highlight in your article that Medicare has reviewing this data, and they're suggesting that if you don't reduce it even further or you have these readmissions, that you're going to be penalized. Tell us about these penalties and how they came into being.
Sure. So the penalties are actually written into health reform. And the way that they work is that CMS, or the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, will track all of a hospital's Medicare readmissions over a 3-year period. And they basically use a predictive model that takes into account how old the patients at a hospital are, how sick they are, to try to estimate how likely that group of patients is to come back into the hospital. And then they look and see what actually happened over that time period. And if a hospital performs, quote-unquote, worse than expected, so if a higher proportion of their patients come back into the hospital than they would have guessed based on how sick or how old their population is, then those hospitals will face a penalty. The penalty comes in the form of a cut in the Medicare reimbursement to that hospital across the board, so not just for their heart failure patients or their MI patients or heart attack patients, but to everybody. And in the first year, so starting fiscal year 2013, which starts this fall, in the first year that penalty can be up to 1%. So a hospital will have about 1% of their payments from Medicare cut if their readmission rates are too high.
Which might not sound like a lot, but when you're talking about that kind of money, these are big penalties for large hospitals.
It is big money, and hospital industry is one in which the margins are pretty slim, and so a 1% cut on Medicare, which is sort of the biggest single payer for a lot of hospitals, can turn out to be a pretty big deal on the hospital's bottom line.
And so thinking about this from a patient perspective, so we're thinking about it now about the penalties and the laws and everything, but the patient leaves the hospital, what are the kinds of things that bring them back, that as the hospital's trying to save themselves from the penalty that they're trying to fix?
I think the biggest thing is trying to improve communication with the outpatient physicians, caregivers, support in the community. When a patient leaves the hospital, they're often leaving with a brand new set of medications, lifestyle interventions, maybe new appointments, and oftentimes just the communication of all those changes to the team that's caring for a patient in the outpatient setting can be quite challenging. Medicare patients see, on average, 2 primary care physicians and 7 specialists in a year to 18-month period. And so if you can imagine the patient trying to coordinate all that information is nearly impossible. So I think the thing that most hospitals have really tried to focus on is making a very clear discharge plan and trying to make sure that the patient and their caregivers and the affiliated physicians all really understand what the goals are going forward. A breakdown in that communication, I think, is at least the most obvious thing that sometimes leads to a readmission.
Well, this all sounds perfect. It sounds like this would benefit patients, and it sounds like hospitals are then under the right reason to do the right work. But somehow, reading your article, it doesn't seem like it may work out that way. We're going to need to take a short break, but we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Karen Joint about hospital readmissions and perhaps what's wrong with that as the indicator for Medicare patients. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Karen Joint from the Harvard Medical School and School of Public Health about hospital readmissions, truth and consequences. And we were talking before the break a little bit about the importance of preventing hospitalizations for cost and some of the laws around this, and of course, benefits to patients and their health. But it sounds like from your article, you don't think it's that straightforward. Share with us a little bit about your concerns about the truth of what this means.
Sure. So I think the part that becomes the complicated part of this whole thing is when we start comparing performance between hospitals. So the patient population that a hospital cares for often has a very, very different set of resources than a different hospital, even in the same community. When a patient leaves the hospital, they're ultimately not going into a vacuum. They're going into some sort of support system, family, friends, community services. And oftentimes, patients face really tremendous challenges in the community that make it very difficult to prevent them from coming back into the hospital. Now, this can happen for a number of reasons. Perhaps one hospital takes care of patients that are sicker than another. And so when their patients go home, they're at a higher risk of coming back into the hospital simply because they have such severe illness. On the other hand, perhaps one hospital takes care of a group of patients who are at a particular socioeconomic disadvantage compared to another hospital. Now, certainly, in my experience, I have some patients, when I've been working at a more private hospital, who come in with a laminated prescription card and the cell phone numbers of all 5 daughters on the back of it. And some patients, on the other hand, are being discharged to a homeless shelter where it's difficult for them to even keep track of their medicines, let alone to be able to take them on a complicated daily regimen. And so when we start judging hospitals against each other, it's very difficult for us to take into account the differences in the populations that they care for. And so we're asking hospitals to just do vastly different amounts of work and different amounts of community outreach and different amounts of support in order to keep patients safely out of the hospital.
You also suggest that that a lot of these quote-unquote preventable readmissions are indeed perhaps not preventable. Tell us a little bit why that's the case.
So when we judge readmissions, we judge what's called all-cause readmissions, which means that no matter what somebody comes back into the hospital for, it's considered to be a readmission. So if you send a patient home who's had pneumonia, for example, and they do fine for a couple weeks at home, but then for an unrelated reason, they end up with a urinary tract infection, or they fall and break their hip, and they come back into the hospital. If it happens to be within 30 days of that last discharge, the hospital is then sort of dinged for that person coming back in, when really it had very little to do with the prior hospitalization and may not have been preventable. There are a number of other things that may be preventable if we sort of think about it on a more community health basis, but may or may not be preventable by what the hospital does. So again, a hospital could discharge somebody home with a careful plan for follow-up, and if that patient faces barriers such as affording their medications or accessing appropriate outpatient care, they may come back in a way that wasn't necessarily prevented by the hospital, although perhaps our health system could have jumped in and prevented it. So I think there's a couple different reasons why hospitalizations may be more or less preventable.
Or maybe someone says they don't want to come back into the hospital to get discharged, but then they change their mind.
Yeah, and we certainly see that.
You know, and because the idea of dying is less appealing than coming back into the hospital. And so it seems that you're lumping lots of people.
Very much so. And, you know, I think sometimes if we really wanted to be patient-centered about this, I think, as you point out, if we were to ask patients, they would trade a better chance of staying alive for a higher chance of coming back into the hospital later. And so we see, for example, with heart failure particularly, the hospitals that have the lowest mortality rates, meaning they do the best job keeping their sick patients alive, have higher readmission rates because those same sick patients are going back out into the community. And I think that's very patient-centered. Sometimes patients need to be in the hospital. They don't come to the ER for fun. They generally come because they feel badly and want us to take care of them. And so sometimes bringing somebody back into the hospital is absolutely the right thing to do.
You also talk about priorities and the fact that there's been so much focus on preventing readmissions, specifically for heart attacks and pneumonia and heart failure, which are important, but thinking about the Medicare admissions is around 10%. And some of the other issues like patient safety and mistakes and things that happen, you know, harmful things that happen to patients in the hospital. And how do you think that plays out in terms of choosing the right priorities to put our emphasis on for patients?
That's a great question. I think in this case, hospitals are very much forced to sort of teach to the test, for lack of a better analogy, that this is a place that CMS is signaling is of key importance right now because they're putting money on the table for it. But again, if we take a step back and think about what really matters to patients, readmissions may not be the only thing that matters to them. And there may be other things like avoiding medication errors in the hospital or better communication or even lower mortality rates that are very important to patients and to clinicians. That's not to say that I think that a lot of the efforts that have gone on around reducing readmissions aren't ultimately good for patients, but it's to say that being single-mindedly focused on this as a quality metric, I think, really takes attention away from the hard work that patients are doing, that hospitals are doing, and patients are doing in a lot of different areas.
And it seems that this is coming in, not in isolation, which I think is what you're arguing, that perhaps we need to really expand this because you also have staffing changes now because of work hour reforms. And so you have many more people coming and going on the provider side. And
absolutely,
so that part's hard. But we had a patient not too long ago who got discharged, and 3 hours later, I happened to see them back in the emergency room. One of the problems, and the family didn't blame the providers, and I don't blame the family, but the patient got home but couldn't fend for themselves, and they discovered it quickly. And rather than keeping the patient at home, they brought him back in and recognized that he needed to go to a skilled nursing facility. Is that, whose fault is that?
Yeah, no, that's a great example.
Should the hospital be punished?
Well, in that case, under the current policies, it will be. But I think you raise a great point that in that situation, the patient probably wanted a chance to succeed at home. And when they realized that it wasn't going to work out, they came back and they got the care they needed, which is to be readmitted to the hospital and ultimately put someplace where they were safe.
Hmm. So what do you think the alternatives are? Your article, you mentioned perhaps maybe focusing on a 3-day readmission or 7-day readmission, but also really focusing on the broader picture of things that are really hurting people in hospital settings like patient safety.
Right. I think the important thing here is just to recognize that readmissions is only one of many things that hospitals can do to improve their quality, and that this focus on readmissions needs to be tempered with an understanding of the differences between hospitals. So things that we could do, for example, as you mentioned, is focusing on some of the shorter-term hospitalizations as opposed to things that may happen 7, 14, 28 days later that are really quite clearly beyond hospital's control. Another thing is recognizing the different challenges that different hospitals face when we think about this. So you can go online right now and look up hospital performance on readmissions, but that may not tell you the whole story. And so hospitals being judged on readmission rates, given the different challenges that they face, I think is problematic. And thinking of more creative ways to adjust some of those rates for the patient population, I think may be worth looking into in the future.
Thinking about our listeners who may themselves have a hospitalization coming up or a loved one, thinking about caregivers and how to put this into action, what kinds of things have you learned that patients and their loved ones can do before leaving the hospital to help just from that their own perspective to ensure a smooth transition and a successful ability to stay home?
That's a great question. I think that really the most important thing is that patients need an advocate. It's really hard for patients when they're in the hospital and they're ill to be able to sort of take full stock of all the things that they need to learn in the hospital before they go home. And having somebody there, a family member or a close friend, or if someone needs extra support at home, even, you know, getting involved with a community organization, and having all those people really get together and help this person in what's a really vulnerable time immediately after hospitalization. Now, some people have lots of family members that can do that, and other people may not have that. But for folks who do have loved ones in the hospital, I think proactively reaching out during that transition period and saying, I'll be there when you're discharged to help you ask the questions that you need to ask, to help you understand the changes in your medicine, and to make sure that you have a follow-up appointment scheduled and you know who to call if you start feeling badly again. Those are really important things, and they can be so hard for patients to do on their own while they're in the hospital.
Well, we want to thank you for being an advocate for the American public with your work and research, Dr. Joint.
Thank you.
It's really a good thing for us to reflect and challenge our assumptions, and maybe we can call on you in the future as well to revisit this really important area of work. We've been talking with Dr. Karen Joint of the Harvard School of Public Health as well as Harvard Medical School about her article in the New England Journal of Medicine about hospital readmissions. Thank you so much for being a guest with us today on Your Health.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Dr. Joint. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend some time talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question that you'd like us to address, you can send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we've got some interesting questions today that actually go back to one of our Research That Matters about how long is CPR futile if you're in hospice?
About a child playing soccer and having some concerning symptoms afterwards.
About what happens if you lose your drug prescription.
And about when should you be concerned about West Nile virus?
Let's listen to our very first House Call today.
Is it useless to get CPR if you're in hospice?
No, this is a great question, and it does touch, Adam, on the article we talked about earlier where we were talking about CPR being done in hospitals for people who have a heart attack in the hospitals where they do it longer. And let me correct myself that the duration of longer and of better benefit was with a median of 25 minutes, which is 9 minutes longer than the group of median of 16 minutes, and
right,
people
so
did
those
better
who did it longer.
With longer.
Still, yeah, and that's what we were talking about. And
but this is different.
This is different here. This is a question that's another kind of variation here, which is if you are in hospice, which in general means that you have 6 months or less to live, is it ever appropriate to say that you want to have CPR done? That's a great question.
It is, and it's a really complex question. Usually when a person and a family enters into hospice, this is a conversation that you have of, you know, at this point, the focus is a shift onto comfort of care and an ease of transition into dying rather than trying to you know, do CPR to try to keep you alive a little bit longer.
Yeah, and I guess there might be circumstances in which, though, mm-hmm. it might be appropriate or not necessarily inappropriate, particularly if this is a decision that's been made thinking about all of the other issues. Perhaps if you were just put into hospice, and yes, you might think it might be within the next 6 months, but you thought, you know, for the next 2 or 3 months while you're putting your affairs in order, in some circumstances, I could see that this wouldn't be inappropriate to say that under some circumstances you might want to have CPR done. I don't know. What do you think, Christy?
Well, and you have the right to change your mind.
Right.
and so that is something to consider. But this is definitely a complex conversation to have as you're working with the hospital people on entry of, okay, so what does this mean? And what would we do? And what do we think about that prolonging life at all anyway?
Yeah, I had a patient, Christy, recently who was in the hospital and they wanted CPR done. They went home, and when they came back into the hospital a week or two later, shortly, and they realized that they perhaps knew were going to go to hospice, a long conversation, actually they changed their mind at that point in time. So this changing of your mind, I think you're right on target, Christy.
But I also think, I mean, when I think about my life and my loved ones, if we were on hospice and having gone through that with my father, the goal for me would be to help me die gracefully. And I communicate this to my husband for when that comes. If at that end of life, I don't think I would want CPR, but, you know, that's a conversation.
Let us know what you're thinking as listeners. That's an important one. Thank you, Christy, for sharing that, because I know that's not easy. Let us know as listeners what you think. Let's listen to our very next house call.
My son recently was playing soccer, and at the end of the game, he was very short of breath and nauseous and scared. He was very upset because he lost to a team that they've always beaten. He didn't appear dehydrated. Could this have just been anxiety?
Well, I think it's good that you thought about a couple possibilities. Did he have enough to drink? And, you know, that's a really common reason why kids sometimes feel bad after a big, intense game, is not having enough fluids in them. But it sounds like that's not the case. And also thinking about anxiety.
Yeah, it sounds like that you thought that this might be more related to mood and possibly mm-hmm. anxiety than you were worried that true dehydration or something more in the strictly biomedical realm. And I think you're probably right on target.
Yeah, well, and I mean, this feeling of shortness of breath and feeling nauseous and scared and like the world is imploding or like you can't catch your breath, those types of are sort of classic feelings. So I don't know if that's exactly how he was feeling, but that is very classic for a panic attack.
Right. You know, one of the things I would recommend is that anyone can do is, first off, make sure that the person, your son, friend, doesn't have asthma, mm-hmm. Because that could change things, and that they're not on any medications for their breathing or a recent cough. And then also, if people know how to take someone's pulse, if their pulse is normal, and then the anxiety might be a lot more kind of how they're feeling. Now, of course, anxiety can raise the pulse too, so if mm-hmm. it's elevated, it doesn't tell you. But in this particular case, reassurance, calm, quiet, maybe a starting place.
Okay, let's take our very next house call.
If you're on a pain contract with your doctor and you lose a prescription that has recently been filled, can your doctor give you another? If not, what are you supposed to do?
Oh, this is a problem, Christy. This is a problem.
So pain contract, for people who may not know, is an agreement between a patient and a physician about pain medications. These are controlled substances and can be addictive and misused. And the doctors are on the line to prescribe appropriately and to follow the rules about doing this responsibly.
And if you've lost your prescription once it's been given to you, doctors worry about that these are being sold or being abused, lots of things that they're worried about. And it's good that you're telling your provider about these aspects, but your provider's in a very difficult situation because he also knows that if you truly are using opiate, narcotic medications for a long period of time and you don't have them, you can go into withdrawal. So it's a very difficult situation about what to do.
It really is. A physician could lose their license for prescribing to lots of people without following the rules. you as a patient, you wouldn't die to withdraw from narcotic medications, but you might want to because it feels really bad and your pain would come back and that would be really hard for you. So I would encourage you to have a very honest and open conversation.
Very honest, very open.
The whole, I mean, just put it all out on the table about what your concerns are, about what happened to that bottle or what could have happened to that bottle. And let the doctor also talk about what it's like to put himself at risk.
Great suggestions. Let's listen to our very last house call.
My husband recently had a fever, chills, and vomiting for 2 days after we returned from camping. With all the talk about West Nile virus, should we be concerned?
Well, I'm concerned about West Nile virus. I tell you, Christy, the mosquitoes have been brutal this year. And even though we're into the fall and they're coming less, you go outside and you get bit seemingly within 5 minutes, 5-10 mosquitoes. And West Nile virus is spread around the country and around North Carolina.
In terms of when should we be concerned, I think you follow kind of the rules that you would for any illness. If your loved one or you are not able to hold down any liquids or food, if you're throwing up so much that you can't hold it down, that would be a reason to go see your doctor.
And certainly if you start getting confused, I mean, if you can't think straight or your loved one is really worried and that fever's been persisting, feel free to ask your doctor, could this be West Nile virus? We don't mind getting asked what you're concerned with because lots of times it's the same things we're concerned with.
And it's also not unreasonable, even in the early stages of an illness, to just go see the doctor, get checked out, touch base with what the story is, and go back through when it would be and how to call or how to get help if it's on the weekend and that sort of thing to try to keep you out of the hospital.
Yeah, because West Nile, there's supportive treatment, but the flu, there's actually medication that you can take.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Christy, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank all our listeners for sending us in really good questions. Anyone out there, you can send us in your own questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also send us messages through our health app or through Twitter and Facebook.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Karen Joint. We want you to join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. And we'll talk with you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.